Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello everybody, Roy Field here. It's almost time for America to elect a new president. So I thought it only right and apt that I rush out, stress on the word rush, in parentheses, a new episode of 10 American Presidents. This is Professor Ewan Morgan from University College London, narrating part one of the life of President Ronald Reagan. I must admit, I found this show one of the hardest, if not the hardest, actually to edit. There is so much material on Reagan from his time before he even became the governor of California that I have to stretch this over two shows. The professor does an amazing job narrating the life of Ronald Reagan. I hope you'll enjoy the show. As I said, this is only part one. Part two should be ready after you know the victor of the election in early November. Lastly, earlier in September, I shared a sneak peek of the upcoming podcast, The Fault Line, on this feed, whose first season will be about the fallout from 9/11 and the build-up to the invasion of Iraq. I said that it'll be premiering at the end of September, September the 29th to be exact. I got a lot of feedback about this and you seem to be rather excited about it. So I just wanted to let you know that The Fault Line is available today. So go and listen to The Fault Line, Bush, Bear and Iraq, which is now available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher and all those other good places where you get your podcasts from. Now on with the show.
This podcast is a Roy Field Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Mr. Pop.
That the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
47 years ago.
When in the course of human events.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you.
Ronald Wilson Reagan, February 6, 1911 to June 5, 2004, was an American politician who served as the 40th president of the United States from 1981 to 1989. Ronald Reagan was born in the small town of Tampico in northern Illinois. And he spent the first 10 years of his life moving around many of the small towns of Northern Illinois. His father, Jack, was a shoe salesman. Unfortunately, Jack had a drink problem, and this meant that he did not hold down jobs for very long. The family eventually settled in Dixon, another Northern Illinois town, in 1920. Jack opened a shoe store of his own, but his alcoholism meant that he was never able to make it a success. Ronald Reagan's main influence on his life was his mother, Nell. Nell imparted her religiosity to him. She was a member of the Church of Christ, and she was an indefatigable optimist. And Nell imparted to Ronald Reagan his most important trait of optimism, his belief that things would always work out for the best. His father, Jack, also had an important influence on him, but it was a negative one. Ronald Reagan was determined that he would never fall into the same pit as Jack. This made him very disciplined, very hardworking, and very competitive throughout his life. Ronald Reagan had a very happy teenage life in Dixon, Illinois. The only cloud on it was his father's alcoholism. But that apart, Reagan became a very popular student in high school. He was an excellent sportsman, specializing in swimming, but his great love was football. And he found his first real girlfriend in the high school. Both of them would go on to Eureka College, which was a Church of Christ college in Illinois, a very small college. Reagan had no funds to support him. He largely existed on savings earned from his summer job as a lifeguard and the jobs he did around campus. Reagan got to Eureka just as the Depression hit the United States.
On Wednesday, October 23rd, 1929, the first waves of panicky selling began to drive down the price of blue chip stocks like Westinghouse and General Electric. The following morning, the fear turned to panic, and brokers began unloading margin accounts at record speed. Stock prices plummeted sickeningly across the board, spurring the rush of sell orders from terrified speculators still more. As anguished shrieks rose up from the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, the visitors gallery was cleared. In less than 2 hours, nearly $10 billion invested in stocks was simply wiped out.
The winds that blew in the 30s in the United States were winds to be remembered and then forgotten hurriedly. Bowling through the dust bowls of the Middle West, scourging from the Atlantic to the Pacific. The winds of the Depression, as deep as it went deep.
The president began this campaign with the same attitude with which he has approached so many of the serious problems of the past 3 years. He sought to create the impression that there was no campaign on at all. Just as he had sought to create the impression that all was well with the United States and that there was no depression.
Mr. Chief Justice, my friends, this is a day of national consecration, and I am certain that on this day my fellow Americans expect that on my induction into the presidency, I will address them with a candor and a decision which the present situation of our people impels. This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Fear. in actual fact, the Depression had hit northern Illinois much earlier because agricultural areas were in economic decline throughout the 1920s. But by and large, Reagan sailed through Eureka without doing much work, and he graduates at almost the depth of the Depression. But Reagan is so confident that he tells his classmates that in 5 years' time, he will be earning $5,000 a year. Now, this was a crazy shot at one of the worst times in American history. And he comes back to Dixon, and he doesn't know what to do with himself. And during his lifeguarding duties, he meets up with this businessman who's on vacation. And this man tells him, look, the most depression-proof industry in the United States now is radio. People are buying radios in growing numbers despite the depressions. And Reagan sets out to build a career in radio. He begins by looking at the top radio stations in Chicago, but finds he can't get a breakthrough. So he decides to move off into the sticks, shall we say, and he makes a breakthrough by getting a test with a radio station in Iowa, the WHO radio station. And that is his entree to a career in radio broadcasting. Reagan's talent for best turning up for him begins here. Depths of the Depression, yet here he is moving into a new job in radio, and he's a great success at it after some initial slip-ups, but he becomes one of the radio's top stars.
It's time, and now for the World Series baseball game.
We take you now to the Polo Grounds.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Speaking now from the Polo Grounds in New York City.
This is the time when he is doing baseball commenting, and he knew very little about baseball. He hadn't actually been to a Major League Baseball game in his life, but he had the tape coming through from the Chicago Cubs Wrigley Field. And he would have to pretend to be at the game and make up things about the game, about what players were doing, about what the crowd was doing. And one time, the tape went dead for 7 minutes, and Reagan had to invent a situation where the game was held up for 7 minutes because of foul balls. And the tape came back on, and off he went. But he was very, very successful at it. But of course, Reagan being Reagan, it wasn't enough for him to be just a radio announcer and a sports broadcaster. What he really wanted to do was to get into Hollywood. The question was how. And he got the radio station to pay for him to follow the Chicago Cubs to their spring training camp near Los Angeles, as good luck would have it. And he managed to find somebody who knew him from Dixon, who was now working as a singer in Hollywood. She got him to an agent, telling the agent that here was the new Robert Taylor. Well, the agent touted Reagan to Warner Brothers. And Reagan was given a screen test at Warner Brothers, and it quickly became apparent that he was no Robert Taylor. But the Warner studio people saw something in him and decided that they would give him a temporary contract. Reagan went back to Dixon, the agent, sent a telegram to say that he was going to be awarded a contract, but it was breakable at 6 months, and that it was barely more than he was getting now. But Reagan said, grab it before they change their minds. In 1937, Reagan says goodbye to Dixon and hello to Hollywood, California.
How do you do, everybody? I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Ronald Reagan. Months ago, I was a sports announcer on a radio station in Des Moines, Iowa. One day, I ran into one of these movie talent scouts. I think I caught him off guard because the next thing I knew, I was taking a screen test for Warner Brothers in Hollywood. I guess it was okay. At least I liked Hollywood. So here I am. They did everything they could to make me feel at home, too. The first picture. Well, what do you think it was about? A radio station. Would you like to see a few scenes?
He's going to be put in B-movies. At this time, of course, Hollywood was running double bills in order to attract clients in the Depression into the cinemas. and they needed to turn out a lot of movies, some of them of dubious quality, but program fillers. And this was to be Reagan's job, to star in B-movies. Interestingly, he is given the makeover by the studios. And of course, in those days, it was normal for stars to be given new names. And Reagan had fears of what he'd end up with, but the studio decides that Ronald Reagan is better than any of the alternatives. That would have been important for Reagan's career, because had he entered politics with a stage name, it would have given his opponents the opportunity to attack him as someone without a shred of reality about him. So the studio in 1937 does Reagan a favor. But for the next 3 years, he's stuck in the B-movies. As he himself would say, the studio didn't want them good, they wanted them Thursday.
You wanted law and order in this town. You've got it.
Go and get a uniform and report to the scrubs.
Why?
Because I think you'd make a football player.
I doubt it.
Try it anyway.
All right, if you insist.
Now, wait a minute. What's your name?
Kip.
George Kip. What's yours?
Reagan had a lucky break by going to Warner Brothers, because Warner Brothers had a reputation, among other things, of being the Irish-American studio. Now, up to this point, Ronald Reagan had not played up his Irishness. Of course, his father, Jack, was an Irish-American, a third-generation Irish-American. But Ronald Reagan did not want to identify with his father. But when he got to Warner Brothers, the Irish-American actors in the studio, people like James Cagney, but most particularly Pat O'Brien, took them under his wing and tried to promote his career. Now, Ronald Reagan took 3 years to make the big breakthrough. Occasionally, he was given roles in A movies, the most important of which was Dark Victory, a 1939 movie starring Bette Davis. He was playing, surprisingly, an alcoholic and played it very well. The studio was never sure about how best to use him. Light comedy appeared to be his forte. And his biggest hit of this early period was probably Brother Rat, which is an eminently forgettable movie about military cadets that is important to Reagan, because this is where he met his first wife, also co-starring in the movie, Jane Wyman.
After we get married, how many sons are we going to have?
How many do you want?
Well, it would be nice to have a full team.
What's your favorite sport?
That's the trouble. Football.
Now, Reagan had his big break in 1940 when Warner Brothers decided to make a biopic of the great Notre Dame football coach Newt Rockne, who had been killed in an airplane crash some 9 years earlier. Now, Reagan was slated to play a tragic footballer who was part of Rockne's 1920 team called George Gipp. And O'Brien pushed him hard for the part. There were others who the studio was also considering. O'Brien lobbied for Reagan and Reagan got the part. Reagan is only on screen for 10 minutes, but he makes a remarkable impact through his athleticism. This is where Reagan's background as a sports fan and a sports activist in his youth pays off. It's a remarkable performance, and he's only on screen for 10 minutes because poor George Gipp dies of infection in pre-penicillin 1920. And in the last appearance in the movie, he's on his deathbed and Pat O'Brien is leaning over him. And Reagan utters the immortal line, "Coach, when the team is down sometime in a game in the future, just tell them to go out and win one for the Gipper." And that becomes Reagan's political slogan when he enters politics some quarter century later.
George.
Yes, Mac.
George, this telegram just arrived from water camp. You've been named fullback on his All-American team.
Me? You wouldn't kid me, Rock.
No, it's on the level. You're gonna be all right, kid.
I haven't got a complaint in the world, Rock. I'm not afraid. What's tough about this, Rock, someday when the team's up against it, breaks are beating the boys. Ask them to go in there with all they've got. Win just one for the Kipper. I don't know where I'll be then, but I'll know about it. I'll be happy.
With this huge box office success of Newt Rockne All-America and the very strong critical reception that his own performance earned, Ronald Reagan's days in the B-movies were over. And from now on, Warner Brothers puts him into A Pictures, beginning with a movie that made even more money than Newt Rockne All-American, Santa Fe Trail. And in Santa Fe Trail, Reagan plays George Armstrong Custer in the last year before the Civil War, where he and Errol Flynn are chasing down the militant abolitionist John Brown, who attempts to spark a slave insurrection in Virginia in 1859. And Brown is played in the movie by Raymond Massey as a kind of demented Hitler-like figure, and would never be allowed in post-war Hollywood, but this was pre-war Hollywood. That success earns Reagan a part in his biggest picture, King's Row. And in this, he plays a happy-go-lucky small-town guy who has the immense misfortune to fall out with a sadistic doctor. And when Ronald Reagan is in an accident, the doctor amputates both legs without need. And the most famous scene in the film is where Ronald Reagan wakes up after the amputation and realizes that his legs have gone, and he screams out the line,
"Randy! Randy! Where's the rest of me?"
Now, this is the second time, of course, that Reagan has played great lines from his bed, but this one became an immense symbol of his new star power. He did the incredibly difficult scene in one take, employing what would later be called method acting techniques, imagining himself to be someone who had lost his legs. He spoke to people who had suffered that happening to them, and he does it remarkably. With the making of King's Row, which is going to be another huge hit, Ronald Reagan is on the cusp of major stardom in Hollywood. The future looks rosy. He's married, he has a child. He got married in 1940 to Jane Wyman. They're the all-American couple played up by the Warner Brothers studio as the happy family of the happiest of all families. But World War II intervenes.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live
in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Japan has therefore undertaken a surprise offensive extending throughout the Pacific area. The facts of yesterday and today speak for themselves. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph. So help us God.
Well, way back in his time in Des Moines, Iowa, Ronald Reagan had joined the Cavalry Reserve in order to indulge his love of horse riding. And as soon as Pearl Harbor happens, he is called up as a reserve officer to fight in World War II. Now, Ronald Reagan has one physical problem. He is extremely short-sighted, so much so that he is assessed at not being able to tell whether a tank is a Japanese or American tank at something like 15 feet. He cannot be sent into active fighting on the front. What happens instead is that he is sent to the motion picture unit, which is making documentaries about the war in Culver City. So Reagan never actually leaves Hollywood during the war, but he can't appear in Hollywood movies. He's a commissioned officer. The only films he appears in World War II are documentary movies. And these documentary movies are quite important because they're morale-boosting films for the troops. They're information films for pilots. How do you identify a Japanese Zero? But he only makes one commercial movie during the war. And that is the Warner Brothers spectacular, This is the Army. It's his biggest box office success. That he doesn't get any money for it because he has only paid his soldiers' pay.
I'd like a couple of dozen military marches, please.
Johnny, what happened to you?
Nothing, I just changed clothes.
You've been enlisted.
Well, you knew it was going to happen sooner or later.
Oh, you look wonderful in that uniform.
Not any better than the rest of the fellas. We all have the same tailor. Say, look, it's 9:30 now, and I got a report at 5:30 in the morning. That gives us 8 full hours to do the town, so let's go.
But Johnny, I can't leave yet. Dad isn't coming back tonight. I've got to keep this store open till 10.
Miss Dibble, this is war.
Now, what's happening during the war is that there's a subtle change in the Reagan-Wyman relationship. He went off to war as the major star of the duo. But during the war, Wyman's own star is beginning to rise, culminating in 1945 when she appears in The Lost Weekend. Ronald Reagan comes back from the war, and the studio doesn't know what to do with him. He's no longer really a young-looking man. He's a middle-aged man. He can't be put in the kind of pre-war roles that he played. And while they are looking for vehicles for Reagan, his wife's star continues to rise until she wins an Oscar in 1948 for Johnny Belinda, where she played the deaf mute who has been raped. While this is going on, Reagan's screen career is going nowhere, and in 1947, the studio put him in a real turkey. It's called That Hagen Girl, and it's significant in Hollywood history as the first adult part that Shirley Temple plays.
Stories all around that you and Grace Gately have... Well, you know what I mean, Tom.
No, I don't know what you mean, but I heard what you said a minute ago, and if you mean what I think...
Well, why not? Everybody in town knows it.
Who am I? We're anxious to forgive and forget, Colonel Bates.
You want to forget years of persecuting a girl whose only crime was growing up to be fine and decent. You should be asking Mary Hagen to forgive you.
Now, in the movie, the 36-year-old Reagan ends up falling for the 18-year-old Temple. It's a patently ridiculous plot, and unsurprisingly, it flops at the box office. Warner Brothers decide that Reagan can no longer be trusted to carry a movie, that his name just doesn't sell enough, like Humphrey Bogart's or Errol Flynn's. Reagan's career following the Hagen girl is on the skids in Warner Brothers. He's put in ever worse movies. He's desperate to get into Westerns. This is what Reagan saw as his future, where he could demonstrate his horse riding skills and his athleticism. But his short-sightedness is patently obvious on screen when he appears in Westerns. He cannot be another John Wayne or James Stewart. He just doesn't have the physical presence. And what Reagan does during this period, rather reluctantly, but whilst he's waiting for the revival of his screen career, he becomes increasingly involved in the Screen Actors Guild. Now, he returns from the war and he's quite left-wing. He is seen by the FBI as someone who might be a potential communist because of his association with front groups. And Reagan is warned off by the FBI about his associations, and that causes him to look more closely at communist infiltration in Hollywood. Now, there's no doubt that the United States Communist Party was hoping to increase its influence within the movie industry, but the possibilities of it becoming dominant were nil. But Reagan becomes part of this belief that the communists are taking over Hollywood. This is the time of major Hollywood strikes by the studio unions. Reagan initially is resistant to congressional investigation of communist activities in Hollywood by the House Un-American Activities Committee. And in 1947, he testifies before the committee that Hollywood will take care of the Reds its own way, that there's no need for government investigations. But at this very moment, the studio heads are signing the Waldorf Declaration of December 1947. Whereby they agree to clean house, rid themselves of anyone suspected of communism, who will not sign loyalty oaths. And the result is the Hollywood Red Scare that begins in late 1947.
Fear of communist subversive activities has developed into hysterical frenzy, which grows daily. Appointed by Congress to investigate, Chairman Parnell Thomas opens the hearing.
Investigating alleged communist influence and infiltration in the moving picture industry must not be considered or interpreted as an attack on the industry itself.
Next on the list of witnesses is Ronald Reagan, who says,
I will be frank with you that as a citizen, I would hesitate or I would not like to see any political party outlawed on the basis of its political ideology, because we've spent 170 years in this country on the basis that democracy is strong enough to stand up and fight for itself against the inroads of any ideology, no matter how much we may disagree with it. But at the same time, I never, as a citizen, want to see our country or become urged by either fear or resentment of this group that we ever compromise with any of our democratic principles through that fear or resentment.
But we agree.
I still
with
think that democracy can do it.
Now, the Screen Actors Guild has a question before it. Does it stand by its declaration of principle to the House and American Activities? Reagan has told the committee that he did not want anybody's civil liberties to be abused on grounds of possible communist affiliation. But now he begins to retreat from that position, and the Screen Actors Guild becomes part of the Second Red Scare in support of the studios. In late 1947, Ronald Reagan and his SAG, two members of his SAG board, testify as friendly witnesses before the House Un-American Activities Committee, which is in process of investigating communist infiltration in Hollywood. Reagan offers an almost Jeffersonian defense of civil liberties and arguing that there should be no repression of individual rights, even if there is communist infiltration. He argues Hollywood can take care of it itself. They are followed by the Hollywood Ten, the hostile witnesses who refuse to recognize the authority of the committee and are cited for contempt of Congress. And they undo all the good, the positive imagery of Hollywood that Reagan and his fellow SAG officials have achieved in their testimony. The Hollywood Ten, of course, will be sent to prison for contempt of Congress, but that is a critical factor in the decision of the studios to sign up to the Waldorf Declaration to drive that they will cooperate in driving the communists out of Hollywood by denying employment in their studios to anyone suspected of communist affinities.
One, two, three.
This is NBC Television.
We have obtained the results from the state of Ohio, which assures victory for President Truman and Senator Barkley. With Ohio's 25 electoral votes, President Truman and Senator Barkley will have a total of 266 votes in the Electoral College. This is the minimum figure necessary for victory. This figure, however, does not take into consideration the very favorable trends still developing in California, Colorado, Idaho, and Nevada. The final Truman-Barkley total will reach and exceed 279 electoral votes.
Now, we have something special to show you. A prediction made months ago by a man who fought hard and who won. We ask you to look and listen.
I will say you, that for the next 4 years, there'll be a Democrat in the White House and you're looking at it.
Now, up until this point, Ronald Reagan has been a fervent liberal and a Democrat. He has voted for Franklin D. Roosevelt in all four presidential elections that Roosevelt won from 1932 to 1944. 1948 is the last presidential election in which Reagan will vote Democrat. His politics are beginning to change on account of the Red Scare. He feels that the Democrats are going soft on communism, not taking the threat seriously enough. There's also a crisis in his personal life. Wyman no longer sees Reagan as somebody she wants to stay married to. His career is going down, her career is going up, and she is frankly bored by his political obsessions. He can't talk about anything else at home but politics. And she describes him to a friend as a pain in the ass. That results in Wyman securing a divorce from Reagan in 1948. The Reagans have had one child of their own. Wyman believes that she can have no more children, and they adopt another child, a one-day-old, in 1945. So Reagan, the family man, suddenly has his family plucked away from him. It's the worst crisis of his life. He begins to do something he's never done before. He begins to drink, and he becomes a real wolf. He is known around town as somebody who squires starlets, stars. He has affairs with a number of them in reaction to the breakup of his marriage to Wyman. Unquestionably, he had affairs with Doris Day, Piper Laurie. Patricia Neal was seen as somebody who also had an affair with him. She denied that that was true. The same of Rhonda Fleming. But without doubt, he became a something of a wolf during this time. The divorce from Wyman means that he has to pay for the upkeep of his family and pay for his own upkeep. So he becomes resentful of the high taxes he now has to pay as a Hollywood star. In his memoir, An American Life, his post-presidential memoir, he talks about his Hollywood days as teaching him the truth about what would later become known as supply-side economics. That if you pay too much of your earnings in tax, you have a disincentive to work harder. And he writes in the memoir, look, when I was a Hollywood star in the late 40s, I wondered whether it was worth making 5 movies a year when I could have done 4 movies and earned more because I would pay less in taxes. It's a complete fabrication. Ronald Reagan would have given his right arm to make 5 movies in any year of the late 1940s when his career was in decline. But it's part of the memory he has of this period, the anti-tax memory. So you have the Red Scare, you have his growing resentment of taxation, and then you have the Korean War. And Ronald Reagan now becomes fervently anti-communist during the Korean War. A second Red Scare in Hollywood wins his complete endorsement. This is at a time when the blacklists and something called the grey lists were at their peak. Now, grey lists were actors and actresses' names would appear on lists of people who had supported either communist organizations or front organizations. And they were investigated and they had to forswear any allegiance to communism. Well, their names were on the grey list before they could be cleared. They couldn't get work in Hollywood. Now, somebody whose name appeared in a grey list was a starlet called Nancy Davis. And Nancy Davis asked to be put in touch with Ronald Reagan to see what help he could give in clearing her of any association with communism. And they meet and she decides that this is the man for her, that she's going to set her cap for him. He doesn't have quite the same reaction. He finds her attractive. She's willing to listen to his politics stories, laugh at his jokes, and generally find him interesting, something that Jane Wyman had stopped doing long ago. So what we end up with is they enter an open relationship. This is around about 1950. That open relationship continues for another 2 years until Nancy finds she's pregnant. And Ronald Reagan does the decent thing and marries her. It is often said that Ronald Reagan would not have married Nancy had she not been pregnant. The truth of the matter is that before long he was besotted with her. She becomes the love of his life. He's obsessed with her. They have 2 children together, but really their main focus is themselves rather than their own children. It's a remarkable relationship, and Reagan becomes emotionally dependent on Nancy to support him throughout thick and thin. And for the first few years of their marriage, it's thin rather than thick.
Unforgettable, that's what you are.
. 1952 political decision, Ike or Stevenson. Reaction: more than 50 million Americans, stirred by one of the hardest fought campaigns of modern times, cast their votes. Ballots topped the old mark by more than 5 million. General Eisenhower voted near his Columbia University home, accompanied by his Mimi. From cities, towns, villages, and hamlets, the voters came to choose the man who would direct the nation's destinies for the next 4 years. In the tiny town hall, Illinois Governor Stevenson waited in line with his neighbors to vote for what he called the best Democratic ticket I've seen. Retiring President Harry Truman voted for his ticket. Ike took a lead of 29 states well before midnight. Republican victory seemed forecast as the bulletins continued to spell Democratic defeat. Democratic hopes of a homestretch miracle dwindled as state after state slid securely into the Republican column. New York Times flashed, Ike's in by a landslide.
In the early 1950s, Ronald Reagan's Hollywood career is on the skids. But he has an ally in the person of his agent, Lew Wasserman. Now, Lew Wasserman is one of the most important but overlooked figures in the Hollywood of this era. Wasserman ends up effectively running the Music Corporation of America. But MCA is really emerging as a conglomerate, and it buys Universal Studios. Now, this is really breaking the Hollywood rules that you cannot be someone who represents actors and is also involved in the production side of the business because of the obvious contradiction of interest there. But Ronald Reagan really uses his muscle within SAG to allow Wasserman and MCA to become both sides of the business. They really favor Universal Studios in their dealings with the studio system. Now, Wasserman cannot save Ronald Reagan's movie career. That is beyond anybody. Wasserman cannot create star power. But what he can do is get Reagan a job in the increasingly important medium of television. In 1954, the General Electric Corporation is looking for someone to act as a corporate spokesman. A corporate spokesman in two ways. Somebody who will front their new Sunday night television series, GE Theater, which is a series of one-off half-hour dramas that will showcase GE's products during the advertising breaks and attract sufficient big names to the theatrical performances to attract an audience on Sunday night. And Ronald Reagan gets the job.
Tonight we're going visiting at the Ronald Reagans again in their new home to see how their many wonderful electric servants are helping them, just as they'll help you, live better electrically. Oh, that's hot.
Oh, it's not.
Oh, but delicious. Everything's just right, isn't it, Patty?
Yeah.
Well, it's the easiest meal to make. My electric servants do everything.
Well, that's part of living better electrically.
The English muffins. My new toaster toasted them. Then I sprinkled on some grated cheese and put them in the toaster oven down here, and that melted the cheese. The egg souffle.
That's something we haven't had in quite a while.
Oh, it's pretty tricky to make.
He now hosts GE's Theater every Sunday night. And he is now seen weekly by more people than saw him in a whole year during his declining Hollywood movie years. There's also something very important about the GE job. When the series is off air, Reagan is expected to travel around the country on morale-boosting visits to the General Electric factories spread around the United States. And there are 133 of them, so that is a lot of travel. Reagan, who has a phobia of flying, insists that he will only do the job if he can travel by train. Gets to the factories, he gives them pep talks. You know, he's a very, very popular speaker with stories about Hollywood days, and he tells some pretty raunchy jokes as well, if it's an all-male audience. But while he's traveling by train around the country, he begins to read voraciously. He's always been interested in politics, and now he's beginning to think about what the conservative ideas are coming through. He comes across numerous journals that pique his interest, but none more so than National Review, which is launched in 1955 under the editorship of William Buckley. The National Review is anti-communist, anti-statist, anti-liberal. And Reagan begins to absorb these ideas And increasingly, these ideas find their way into the talks he gives to GE employees. They're reinforced by the fact that the tales he hears when he visits factories, usually, I suspect, from management rather than from workers, is that government red tape is strangling the industry, taxes are too high, regulations are overbearing, and government is too pro-union. And of course, this becomes manna from heaven for the GE corporate leadership, because Reagan is now putting over their message in terms that the common man can find appealing. And before long, Reagan has become an out-and-out conservative. He's already voted for Eisenhower in 1952, and he moves closer and closer to right-wing organizations throughout the 1950s. Now, before long, the Republicans begin to take note of him, particularly Richard Nixon, who is intending to run for president in 1960. And he begins to court Reagan and writes to him and said, what a wonderful speaker you are. You have the capacity to put over views in ways that appeal to the common man that politicians like myself can't do. He enlists Reagan to speak for him in 1960, in the 1960 election. Now, Reagan said, why don't I become a Republican? I'm a registered Democrat. Why don't I become a Republican? And Nixon said, no, I don't want you to do that. I want you to be a Democrat for Nixon. And in 1960, Ronald Reagan is on the front line in support of Richard Nixon. Now, that is critically important. Ronald Reagan has come out into the open. Okay? He can no longer be seen as a Democrat. And within 2 years, he makes the inevitable transition. In 1962, he finally registers as a Republican.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
Now, 2 years later, the Republican Party is tearing itself apart between its liberal moderate wing, led by Governor of New York Nelson Rockefeller, and Senator Barry Goldwater of Arizona, the champion of the right wing.
President Eisenhower said only 2 hours ago from this very rostrum, the Republican Party should reject extremism from either the left or the right. Precisely 1 year ago today, on July 14, 1963, I warned that the Republican Party is in real danger of subversion by a radical, well-financed, highly disciplined majority.
Rockefeller argues very similarly to Dwight D. Eisenhower, that the New Deal is too popular to roll back, that what we have to do is accept what Roosevelt's 1930s program did in terms of establishing Social Security, protection for unions, protection for farmers, protection for home mortgages, etc., etc., by the federal government. And Barry Goldwater says, no, we've had enough of being a Me Too New Deal party. Let's give the people a choice rather than be an echo. And Ronald Reagan finds this a very alluring message. And he gives whatever support is needed for Goldwater's candidacy.
I accept your nomination with humbleness, with pride, and you and I are going to fight for the goodness of our land. Thank you. I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. That moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue.
Goldwater's candidacy, however, is soon in trouble. It becomes clear that Americans are not yet ready for somebody with his highly conservative views. We're talking about a country where the majority of voters are registered Democrats, where government programs are popular, because, of course, government programs up until the mid-1960s largely benefited white, middle-class and upper working-class Americans. The government had not yet moved into racially oriented programs like civil rights, affirmative action and voting rights. So in 1964, Goldwater is swimming against the tide. And in desperation, a group of his financial backers based in California decide that the only salvation for the campaign is to recruit Ronald Reagan to give a nationwide address on Goldwater's behalf. These financial backers know Reagan from his days as the GE spokesman. He's friendly with many of them. They realize that he is someone who can be an asset to the cause. They don't quite realize just how much he can be. In 1964, in the presidential campaign of 1964, they enlist him to give this nationwide address on television for Barry Goldwater. And anybody who watches it realizes how effective Reagan is as a political spokesman on television. He addresses the audience directly. He's not strident. He's very calm. He supports his case with facts, highly selective facts perhaps, but nevertheless, he isn't a ranter, he isn't a raver, he's a calm voice of conservative reason. And this becomes a dramatically successful broadcast.
The following pre-recorded political program is sponsored by TV for Goldwater Miller on behalf of Barry Goldwater, Republican candidate for President of the United States. Ladies and gentlemen, we take pride in presenting a thoughtful address by Ronald Reagan. Mr. Reagan.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you and good evening. The sponsor has been identified, but unlike most television programs, the performer hasn't been provided with a script. As a matter of fact, I have been permitted to choose my own words and discuss my own ideas regarding the choice that we face in the next few weeks. I have spent most of my life as a Democrat. I recently have seen fit to follow another course. I believe that the issues confronting us cross party lines. Now, one side in this campaign has been telling us that the issues of this election are the maintenance of peace and prosperity. The line has been used, we've never had it so good. But I have an uncomfortable feeling that this prosperity isn't something on which we can base our hopes for the future. No nation in history has ever survived a tax burden that reached a third of its national income. Today, 37 cents out of every dollar earned in this country is the tax collector's share. And yet our government continues to spend $17 million a day more than the government takes in. We haven't balanced our budget 28 out of the last 34 years. We've raised our debt limit 3 times in the last 12 months. And now our national debt is 1.5 times bigger than all the combined debts of all the nations of the world. We have $15 billion in gold in our treasury. We don't own an ounce. Foreign dollar claims are $27.3 billion. And we've just had announced that the dollar of 1939 will now purchase 45 cents in its total value. As for the peace that we would preserve, I wonder who among us would like to approach the wife or mother whose husband or son has died in South Vietnam and ask them if they think this is a peace that should be maintained indefinitely. Do they mean peace? Or do they mean we just want to be left in peace? There can be no real peace while one American is dying someplace in the world for the rest of us. We're at war with the most dangerous enemy that has ever faced mankind in his long climb from the swamp to the stars. And it's been said if we lose that war, and in so doing lose this way of freedom of ours, history will record with the greatest astonishment that those who had the most to lose did the least to prevent its happening. Well, I think it's time we ask ourselves if we still know the freedoms that were intended for us by the Founding Fathers.
At the end of the 30-minute talk, representative of Goldwater's campaign takes over from Reagan and asks people to send money to Goldwater headquarters because the campaign is now running out of funds. And that appeal, coming on the back of Reagan's talk, turns around the financial problems of the Goldwater campaign. Money is soon rolling into its coffers. The speech is played on local television channels in the final weeks of the campaign and continues to get money for Goldwater. What it doesn't get is votes for Goldwater. And Goldwater goes down to a crushing defeat in 1964.
Hour news and Pettit reporting. Chicago's racially torn west side is quiet, with 2,500 guardsmen on hand to make sure it stays that way. The area was rocked with violence for 4 succeeding nights when police professed their inability to check the mobs. The guardsmen were called out. North Vietnam's President Ho Chi Minh told the world tonight that he's not ready for peace and is ordering the partial mobilization of reserve officers and rear guard forces. The Red Leader said his people will fight on in spite of American bombings. No mention of any trial of those captured American airmen. U.S. officials had warned North Vietnam earlier of the probable dire consequences of any such trials.
Ronald Reagan, who has titled his talk Time for Choosing, that's what it becomes known as. That's the great theme of the talk. And it appears that the American people have chosen and they don't want conservatism. But Ronald Reagan never gives up. And soon the Republicans are back on the up again. The Democrats begin tearing themselves up over how far they are going to go to provide civil rights and welfare assistance to African Americans. The Vietnam War takes off in 1965, provoking huge protests on campus. Public disorder becomes a major political issue. Crime is on the rise. Street crime is on the rise. Conservatives find it easy to attack the Democrats for being soft on crime and more concerned with the rights of the criminal than the rights of the victim. Now, all this boils up into a revival of conservatism from the debacle of Goldwater's 1964 campaign to the 1966 midterms. Among the states that will hold a governorship election in 1966 is California, which has just become the largest state in the Union. It takes over in 1963 from New York as the most populous state, so obviously it is the jewel in the crown of any party looking to make an electoral breakthrough. Now, the only problem is that the Democrats have a two-term popular governor, Edmund Pat Brown, the father of a recent California governor, Jerry Brown. Now, Edmund Pat is better known as Pat Brown. His real name is Edmund. But Pat Brown has been the builder of modern California. His administration has built massive roads. It's built universities. It's effectively created the University of California system, the best public university system in the United States, possibly the world. And generally, it has an amazing record. But it is also very liberal on minority rights, and it has supported, among other things, the laws to force the opening of the suburbs to black settlement. It has attacked the use of restricted covenants and other techniques to limit the sale of suburban housing only to whites, and this has become a really hot issue in California. Now, Ronald Reagan had not intended to run for governor in 1966. His supporters, wealthy backers are begging him to run. And he says, no, I'm somebody who likes to give speeches. I don't think I want to be an office holder. But eventually, he is worn down. And despite the reservations of Nancy Reagan, who feels that her husband might not do well in the campaign, Ronald Reagan enters the Republican primary and he wins it. His first job is to unite the badly divided California Republican Party between its Goldwater wing and its Rockefeller wing. And Ronald Reagan does that, and he realizes that the way to do it is to play on his personal appeal. And he comes across as someone who isn't this hardcore ideologue, but is an all-round decent guy, full of common sense and able to communicate his ideas to the common people. A united Republican Party behind Ronald Reagan spells trouble for the Democrats, but they don't take him seriously. They treat him as just an actor. They can't believe the Republicans have handed them the good fortune of choosing a know-nothing actor as the head of their gubernatorial ticket.
The fundamental question raised by the candidacy of my opponent is still unanswered less than a week before election and a day and a year since he set out to win the governorship of this day. The unanswered question that disturbs millions of concerned California is this: what has Ronald Reagan ever done for the state of California in his entire life, other than make a motion picture, Bedtime for Bonzo, or Ladies on Probation, or The Last Stand of Custer? I mean, these are the things While we've been building this great big state of California, its colleges and its universities and its freeways, where was my opponent?
You've heard a great deal about my lack of experience. That's true. Lack of experience actually in holding public office. But I know that there comes some times when if you want a job done, maybe you get somebody in who hasn't found out all the things you can't do. I'm quite sure that perhaps I'll make mistakes, but they'll be the mistakes that you can understand. They'll be the mistakes of trying to improve efficiency and productivity, trying to cut overhead and waste and streamline and put modern business practices into the running of this government. Partisanship is going to end on November 8th if we're elected, and we're going to set up a government for all of the people. I know that many of you are Democrats, and I offer to you a government not based on any narrow partisan concept, but a government that's based on the idea of all of the people of this state having a voice in their own destiny, some control in running their own affairs, yes, and in spending their own money, because I believe we can have economy and government if we have a governor who believes in economy and who believes the cost can be cut.
The race in the West that has captured complete national attention is the gubernatorial contest in the state of California. It's the actor against the old pro. The actor, Republican Ronald Reagan, against the incumbent governor, Edmund Pat Brown. Ronald Reagan comes from the sound stages of Southern California. He finds his great strength in that part of the state where most of the people live. Governor Brown found himself an underdog early in the campaign. He's been gaining, but maybe not enough. He needs a substantial amount of votes in the north of the state to have any chance of winning.
For a report on the nation's hottest gubernatorial fight, here now is Edward P. Morgan, broadcasting from Los Angeles.
The California electorate is behaving a little like a woman buying a new hat. It can't seem to make up its mind. At least the pollsters say 16 to 20% of the voters still are undecided in the major race. These undecideds are the only real hope Governor Pat Brown has, and the trouble is he himself is old hat. After two Brown terms, voters are shopping around for newer, flashier political millinery, and some of them think that they have found it in the person of ex-actor Ronald Reagan. Brown himself admits that Reagan now is ahead in the polls. But it's the undecided margin who still say they don't know what they're going to do that the Democrats, rather desperately, are counting on. Who cares about the Brown-Reagan race outside of the people in this most populous state of the Union? Few perhaps except professional politicians. But in this era of television, if Reagan should win, he would make a devastating contender for the Republican presidential nomination in 1968.
They underestimate Reagan badly, and they run ads against him. This man's an actor. What does he know? He's got no experience. We've got a two-term governor who's built the state up. But Ronald Reagan feels the pulse of California. He feels the pulse of a lower middle class and a lower white middle class and an upper white working class, which is fearful of the advancement of minority rights, which is worried about the moral decline on university campuses where free sex, dirty language, and anti-Vietnam War protests go hand in hand. And they're worried about rising crime. Now, Reagan plays what is called dog whistle politics, okay? He never comes out and says, we whites, we need to band together to hold the line against black advancement. But he uses coded messages. He says, among other things, look, nobody can be told by government who they can sell their property to. It's a fundamental individual right. It's up to them. He talks about the mess in Berkeley. Berkeley, of course, is the center of the University of California system where anti-war protests are at its peak. And he uses Berkeley as a symbol of the moral decline of California youth and the failure of the Brown administration to do anything about it. And finally, he plays on white fears that blacks are engaged in welfare cheating and in street crime. And in launching his campaign for governor, he uses quite coded language that everybody knows what he's talking about. Our streets are becoming a jungle by night. Racial coding of that is clear to whites. Whites know that Ronald Reagan is on their side. And what happens on election day, because the Democrats haven't counted his message, he wins big time. He wins by a million votes against a two-term incumbent. And what is remarkable about the 1966 election for the governorship of California is how many blue-collar Democrats change over to the Republican Party to support Ronald Reagan. Reagan is now elected governor of California, and he's asked by a reporter, "What kind of governor will you be, Mr. Reagan?" And Reagan replies, "Don't know. I've never played a governor before."
Place your left hand upon the Bible, raise your right hand. In the name of the state of California, against all enemies, foreign or domestic,
I do.
That you will bear true faith and allegiance to the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the state of California.
I do.
Not too many days ago, our country was on fire because an assassin's bullet took one man's life. Whatever you may think of Martin Luther King, whether you approved or disapproved, I think something of America was killed also.
When we talk about the convention and the delegates, there are estimates ranging from, I've heard 38%, I've heard 60% of Goldwater delegates and alternates returning this year to Miami. Do you see yourself as the only hope of the conservatives in the party? They certainly are not going to rally around Nelson Rockefeller, and many of them may not around Richard Nixon. Where else do they have to go except you?
As you know, it won't go along anymore with using those labels. I've been working for 2 years trying to get the party to drop the labels.
But a great many people do use them.
And yet, we've been very successful, though, with getting them to. I think there is a different philosophy or belief in the Republican Party today at the grassroots level and on up through the pros. I think you will find the Republican Party today is far more willing to see good in other Republicans in the interest of unity and in the interest of winning. Great desire. We've had our bloodbath and learned a lesson from it.
The inflation and the unusual growth in the numbers of young people who are going on to college today have presented great problems for higher education. They've had a higher percentage of increase than just our normal increase in population. And thus, they have been a top priority. We have met this increased problem of theirs by making education top priority and trying to meet their problems. At times, however, I think we have to recognize that academic freedom, and I believe that it must be preserved with all my heart, I believe that, but academic freedom cannot be used as an excuse for fiscal license or as a screen for excessive spending or irrelevant activities.
Ronald Reagan becomes California's 33rd governor in January 1967, and he's got an immediate problem. The Brown administration had spent so much on public projects that the state revenues are virtually non-existent. There is a real problem for the budget in his first fiscal year as governor, and California, like most states, has a constitutional amendment requiring a balanced budget. Ronald Reagan initially suggests, well, we'll just cut spending for every department by 10%, a patently ridiculous idea, but it showed his inexperience. And it soon becomes evident to him that the only way to bridge the fiscal gap is to raise taxes. And he decides to do it early in his administration so that he can blame the necessity on the preceding Brown administration. And he sells it to the voters in this way, and as a consequence, actually suffers no political damage. Reagan at this time is showing a pragmatic capacity for compromise. He's learning on the job that government is about compromise, that it's not about simply about great speeches, it's about doing things, and doing things requires you to compromise, particularly when you're faced with an assembly which is controlled by the opposition party. So what Reagan's first term looks like is a mess of his ideological beliefs, a complete rubbishing of them. not only did he raise taxes, he developed a fine environmental record and conservation record that any liberal would be proud of. He stops the development of the Brown Project to flood a valley in Northern California, which belongs to an Indian tribe. So, you know, he's ahead of his time in that way in recognizing Native American rights. He supports education. Education spending goes up on his watch. He also, by the way, signs abortion bill. The Supreme Court has not yet legalized abortion, but the states can do so. California has a problem because something like 100,000 women, it is estimated a year, die of barbaric backstreet abortions or unsanitary abortions undertaken in Mexican clinics. As a consequence, a bipartisan group promotes an abortion legalization bill in the first trimester of pregnancy. It's very, very loosely defined. A woman's physician deems abortion as necessary to protect the woman's well-being. It becomes legal. Reagan signs it. He later has to express regret for it, but he does sign it. So when you look at Reagan in his first term, is he a conservative? Well, he is a conservative in two ways. While Reagan is doing all these compromises, he's uncompromising in his conservative rhetoric. So Reagan's rhetoric is utterly at variance with his political actions. To hear him, you would think he was Barry Goldwater Mark II, but if you look at his record, it's quite different. Where Reagan's actions are as conservative as his rhetoric is in his dealing with student protest on the university campuses of the University of California. There, Reagan adopts a tough line. He sends in the National Guard to Berkeley. He engages in rhetoric which suggests, at one stage, he said, okay, if they want a bloodbath, let's give it to them, in terms of confrontation between the National Guard and anti-war students.
At Berkeley, there was a plot of land that had been taken by protesters. The university owned it. They were trying to turn it into a parking lot. The protesters claimed it as a park for the people.
Reagan orders the California Highway Patrol and Berkeley police officers to the park. While the crowd continues to swell, Reagan's chief of staff sends reinforcements to the scene. He tells them to use whatever methods they choose against the protesters. Not long after, police start firing buckshot and tear gas. One student is killed, and an estimated 128 people are admitted to local hospitals. Reagan declares a state of emergency and sends in the National Guard.
He was attempting to crack down on student protesters. You know, depending on your political point of view, he was either successful in doing so or he was authoritarian.
Those people told you for days in advance that if the university sought to go ahead with that construction, they were going to physically destroy the university.
Now, why did you negotiate many times?
Negotiate? What is to negotiate? What is?
University is a public institution.
That's right.
Important institution.
But the university,
its own community, and for the community of Berkeley that live around it.
All of it began the first time some of you who know better and are old enough to know better let young people think that they had the right to choose the laws they would obey as long as they were doing it in the name of social protest.
Where Reagan's conservatism on his rhetoric and his actions are in tune is on his very firm, some would say overly firm, handling of the student protests in the University of California campuses. He sends the National Guard into Berkeley. There is trouble on numerous other campuses. In one, two students are killed by police. When Ronald Reagan is questioned on this, he utterly supports the police action and utters the infamous word, if they want a bloodbath, we can give it to them. Many people feel that this is going too far. This is shortly after National Guardsmen have killed four students in Kent State University in Ohio. And Ronald Reagan faces a public backlash. This is an election year. He's running for his second term. He tones the rhetoric down and he wins re-election, but by nowhere near the same margin as he first won office in 1966. But 1970 is a bad midterm year for Republicans nationwide. The Nixon government is unpopular. The Republicans now cannot blame the Democrats for the nation's problems. And Reagan at least holds on to California, where many Republican governors elsewhere go down to defeat. Reagan's second term is significant for his successful enactment of welfare reform. This is his key policy for his second term. Welfare reform cracks down on what he calls welfare cheating. It makes welfare eligibility tougher to gain. But if you do have welfare eligibility, the compromise he made was that he would be paid more money. So welfare reform in the States, and it also pioneers what's known as workfare, where some welfare recipients, to keep their benefits, have to go on community work projects. And that is an idea that the National Republican Party will pick up in time. But by and large, Ronald Reagan's second term is really a winding down of his state career and a preparation for his national career and national ambitions to flower.
I hope you enjoyed part one of the life and times of Ronald Reagan. Just thought I'd let you know that I do a load of other podcasts. If you got this far, you might be interested in that. I do a show called Mid-Atlantic, which looks at US and UK and Canadian political news. And it's a bit of a compare and contrast, really, which comes out fortnightly. So why don't you go into a podcatcher if you like politics and go and search that out. It's called Mid-Atlantic. We have a Facebook group for 10 American presidents. Now, I'm somewhat sporadic with me seeding it, but it is there. There are some 600 to 700 members of that group. So if you really enjoyed this episode, or if you've got any questions, why don't you go onto Facebook, type in 10 American presidents, the numerals 1 and 0, American presidents, and go and join the Facebook group. As I alluded to before, I actually am somewhat of a prolific podcaster. My first podcast was a thing called How Jamaica Conquered the World. Now, there will be a book coming out next year, basically entitling The Spread of Jamaican Influence Throughout the World Since Jamaica Became Independent. And one of those episodes is going to include Kamala Harris, who's, of course, of Jamaican parentage. So if you want to discover the overachievement of the island of Jamaica throughout the world, things like hip-hop and General Colin Powell, they're all part of the series of How Jamaica Conquered the World. Of course, with my accent, it belies the fact that I am English, and I do a podcast entitled The Things That Made England. Primarily I do it with David Crowther, though Luke Baxter has also joined the fray there. So if you like somewhat of a sideways glance on the cultural artifacts which are very important to defining English culture, why don't you go and search out on a podcatcher of your choice The Things That Made England. As well as that, I do a monthly podcast called Map Corner. I'm an incredible map geek, and I think most people actually are when you scratch the surface. I do a show called Map Corner with the wonderful Claire Asprey. We do it monthly and we look at things to do with the world of geography and cities and space. This month, I do an audio postcard from Berlin and we speak to Deirdre Mask, who's got a book out called The Address Book, which looks at what our addresses actually say about us all over the globe. And now, lastly, I do a conference once, twice a year called Intelligent Speech. Obviously, during the pandemic, the conference has had to be online as opposed to physical. Did do it in New York last year. There should be a conference at the end of January. And what I do is I get the best kind of podcasters and thinkers online. And you, dear listener, can listen to them opine about a whole variety of subjects. There should be another Intelligent Speech conference at the end of January. I haven't exactly committed to the date, but it's going to be round about them. But if you want to have a look at some of the talks which we did in this year's Intelligent Speech Conference, why don't you go onto YouTube, type in Intelligent Speech Conference. There's a whole channel dedicated to it, and you'll see great speakers there. That's me. I'll see you all again very soon. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.